RN, your world unfolding.
On RN and online at abc.net.au, this is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Did you know it's estimated that 30% of the world's population are defined as middle class? And in the next few decades, this could climb to 60%. China especially, and other emerging economies, are experiencing increasing levels of prosperity. But it's a very different story in the West. Technology and globalization are killing jobs, especially for low and semi-skilled workers. For these workers, well-paid, secure employment, an affordable home and family life is becoming more of a middle-class dream than a reality. This has been felt in parts of the US and Europe for some time now, but has only recently touched Australian society. This erosion of middle-class opportunity has some commentators worried. Tonight, can democracy survive a disappearing middle class? Highlights from a recent forum presented by the free market think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies. Your speakers are Francis Fukuyama, political scientist from Stanford University and author of The End of History and recently Origins of Political Order. John Keane is Professor of Politics at the University of Sydney and Director of the Institute for Democracy and Human Rights. Benjamin Herskovich is a policy analyst with the Centre for Independent Studies and their Beijing-based China correspondent. And we begin with an Australian perspective from demographer Bernard Salt from KPMG. He's a well-known author, commentator and columnist with the Australian newspaper. Bernard Salt.
My view of looking at middle Australia through the census is that these are people that are living very ordinary, unglamorous lives. What I see in Australia, particularly over the last 10 years, where our culture has pursued exceptionalism, and that involves almost the support of, or the pursuit of, celebrity and the support of minorities. But we're forgetting about middle Australia, forgetting about that silent majority, that dutiful component of Australians that go to work, PAYE taxpayers, that raise families, that have mortgages, that commute from middle suburbia in places like Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. It is that community, the stability of that community, that delivers this nation its prosperity and its stability. The welfare, well-being, the narrative of life in middle Australia, in middle suburbs, is actually what makes this country tick. Now, my concern is that there is a growing narrative of concern about, or a backlash, if you like, against middle Australia. There's been some element there for maybe 20, 30 years or so where life in the burbs is regarded as unglamorous, a little unsophisticated, a little boring, if you like. More recently, there's been concerns about the term middle-class welfare. My view is that the middle class would regard any returning of tax through benefits would really be viewed as, well, you're simply giving back taxes that you should never have taken in the first place. My view is that middle Australia, middle class, the middle class is actually the basis to driving the Australian economy. It makes everything tick, makes everything work. But this is not to say that there are not problems with the middle of Australian society. And I think this is particularly coming through in the workplace and in our shift in employment since the global financial crisis. In the 5 years leading up to the global financial crisis, that is May 2003 through to May 2008, the number of jobs added to the Australian continent was 1.4 million. You could be in retail, you could be in agriculture, you could be in finance, you could be in real estate, you could be in health, you could be in professional services, and there were people being added to your sector. No one felt threatened. Everyone felt confident. People maxed out their credit card, built and bid up property values on a weekend. That is the very definition of a boom. The middle class was not under threat during the boom. Everyone felt prosperous. In the 5 years since the global financial crisis, May 2008 through to May 2013, the number of jobs added to the Australian continent was 840,000. The job growth has dropped by about a third over the last 5 years compared to the preceding 5 years. There's been a downturn. That is not my point. The point is that since those 840,000 jobs has bunched up in a couple of sectors, and those sectors where there has been extraordinary job growth over the last 5 years hasn't been necessarily in mining, although mining has added about 100,000 jobs. The runaway success has actually been in health and social assistance, professional services, education and training. At the other end of the spectrum is the real concern, I think, for Middle Australia. There has been a diminution, an erosion in net terms of jobs in the manufacturing sector of 150,000. It's not just manufacturing, it's warehousing, it's agriculture, it's retail, it's tourism. Up until the global financial crisis, you could be a 15-year-old, barely literate, barely numerate, living in the western suburbs of Sydney or in the western suburbs and northern suburbs of Melbourne, and you could get a job in a factory, on a farm, in a shop, in a warehouse or as a waiter. Where does unskilled, low-skilled, barely skilled Australians from the lower end of the middle class get a job in the back half of this decade? I think there has been a skills shift over the last 5 years. The jobs that are expanding in health, in education, in mining, in professional services all require either university degree or technical training. The best thing the middle class can do for its kids is to give them either a university degree or technical training. I think that there is an issue with providing a narrative for the way in which life can be lived in metropolitan Australia for the lower end of the middle class. People earning perhaps 40,000 to 60,000, shop assistants, if you like, or labourers, if you like. What is the narrative for life for these people in, say, the western suburbs of Sydney and the western suburbs of Melbourne? It also brings into focus the difficulty, I think, in getting access to affordable housing. The middle class, the story of the middle class is that you can always make a go of it in Australia if you're prepared to work hard. Well, the problem is that unless you have skills in the western suburbs of Sydney, in the middle class, I don't think that pathway is open any further, because all the job expansion is in the technical and skilled sectors of the economy. And even so, there is concern about access to affordable housing. I see the middle class being frustrated in terms of employment, in terms of the traditional pathways into prosperity, into that Australian narrative of life, of how we live life in the suburbs. I think that there are major issues with regard to providing housing, to providing jobs for the middle class, that for the lower end of the middle class, that we will struggle with over the next 5 years or so. What I want the Australian people to understand and to remember is that 18 million people dutifully going to work, paying taxes, taking out a mortgage, raising kids, commuting to work, is actually what delivers stability and prosperity to a nation of 23 million people. I think we should be supporting the middle class and even celebrating the ordinary lives of middle Australians. Thank you very much.
Bernard Salt, KPMG partner based in Melbourne. Can democracy survive a disappearing middle class? Next up is Professor Francis Fukuyama, political scientist at Stanford University.
If you look at the developing world, one of the biggest underlying trends over the last generation has been the rise of a global middle class. Since 1970, world output has about quadrupled. And part of that rising prosperity has meant that many countries around the world now have increasingly large middle classes. The number of democracies around the world has gone from about 40 in 1970 to about 110, 120 electoral democracies in, let's say, 2012. And part of the reason that you're getting more democracy in places like Indonesia, India, Brazil, South Africa, Turkey, is because each of these countries has an increasingly strong middle class. And in fact, I think a lot of the instability or the uprisings that we've seen beginning with the Arab Spring in 2011, continuing through the protests in Taksim Square in Istanbul, and then the protests in Brazil earlier this year, are driven really by the same underlying social phenomenon, which is the fact that you now have large numbers of well-educated, meaning a few years at least of university education people who have assets that they don't want the government to bother or take away from them, and who are connected through technology to the rest of the world. And it is precisely that group of people that led the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, originally in the Arab Spring, and in these other protests. There are various estimates. This is a trend that is going to continue well into the future. There's a Goldman Sachs study that came out a couple of years ago that said that currently, by their definition, the middle class, which is the middle three quintiles of the global population distribution, is about 31% of global population, but in the year 2050 is going to rise to almost 60%. If you put this in terms of numbers, there's another EU study that says currently globally the middle class may stand at about 1.8 billion, but it's going to hit 4.9 billion by 2030. And so you're talking about a phenomenon that we're in the middle of that is going to continue well into the future. And I think Ben Herskovitz is going to talk about whether this is going to have an impact on the prospects for stability and democracy in China. So that's one part of the story. But I think that there's another part of the story that isn't so positive, which really has to do with the erosion of the middle class in the developed or the rich country world. Now, let me just go back a little bit and talk about why it is that having a broad middle class is important for a democracy. If you recall the story that was put forward by Karl Marx about what would happen as countries industrialize, he said the following. Industrialization is led by a class he called the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie are people that own property. They own the productive assets in a society. They set up capitalist industries, and the proletariat emerged as their workers. That class exploited the proletariat. They got richer and richer. The proletariat was progressively immiserated. The system as a whole would come to a halt because of what Marx called the crisis of overproduction, meaning that modern technology was so productive, it produced so much stuff, but the people who actually made the stuff couldn't afford to buy it, and so demand would collapse, and then there would ultimately be a proletarian revolution as the have-nots redistributed property away from the haves. Now, question is, why didn't this scenario of Marx's ever come to pass? And the reason is really the middle class. That is to say, throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries, as Europe and the United States were industrializing, it turned out that the real wages of the working class kept rising. And it kept rising to the point where that working class no longer actually thought of itself as a disadvantaged, exploited a proletariat, but rather entered the middle class where people could afford to own a house, they could go on vacations, they could buy their recreational vehicle, and so forth. And so the classic Detroit auto worker of the 1950s and 1960s at the height of America's manufacturing industrial period represented precisely that kind of broad base of people that supported democracy and a market economy. And I think that around the world, it is exactly this kind of person, the presence of a large base of this kind of person who supports democracy and makes it stable. If you want to see what happens when you don't have a middle class, I guess from Australia, you don't have quite the same vision of this, but let me tell you that that part of the world is Latin America. Latin America is the part of the world that has the most skewed income distribution, in which there are small, very oligarchic elites in most countries, and then very large masses, not of middle-class people, but of pretty impoverished people. So even though Latin America is democratic, it's not a very happy kind of democracy. And I think one of the reasons that you want the middle class to be broad and secure is precisely so as to provide the base of legitimacy for a group of citizens who really have a stake in the society and therefore support its democratic institutions. So this is where I think we are now running into problems, and it's actually quite interesting listening to Bernard Salt, because whatever problems he detects in Australia in the last 5 years, believe me, in the United States, this has been going on for much more than a generation. And you are an extraordinarily lucky country if this erosion of middle-class employment has only taken place since the great financial crisis. You may have followed the fact that the city of Detroit just went bankrupt, but that is, I think, symbolic of the pervasive deindustrialization that has taken place in the United States over the past, well, really since the 1970s. And in terms of numbers, essentially for male workers in the United States, median incomes have stagnated. They have gone up only marginally since the 1970s. So that means already a period of some 40 years in which basic incomes of working families have not increased. Now, part of that has been masked by a number of other kinds of policies and social changes. So now in the United States, most working families have two income earners because of all the women that entered the workforce. But that in itself also has spin on social consequences in terms of decreasing family stability, because basically men in a post-industrial economy are much less employable than women of comparable skill and education levels. And then the other policy matter that I think Australia would be, it would be good to think twice about this, is the subsidization of mortgages, precisely because housing in the United States became unaffordable for many middle and working class families. And part of the reason we had a subprime mortgage crisis in 2008 was, again, because of implicit government subsidies that was driven in the end by this growing inequality. The statistics on inequality in the United States, and by the way, I could have shown you some charts that would indicate that growing concentration of wealth at the top of the income distribution, it may have been only going on in Australia in the last 5 years, but with a very few exceptions, this is a universal phenomenon across the developed world. So it is also a very big problem in Europe as well. This is a skewing of the income distribution that we've not really seen most of the time. We've not seen this really since the period just before the Great Depression. Most Americans tell themselves that that's okay as long as there's a lot of social mobility, intergenerational social mobility. But it turns out that that's been falling in the United States as well. And so in many American cities, the probability that if you're in the bottom part of the income distribution means that your child and your grandchildren still do not have a very large probability of rising to one of the higher income brackets in the course of 20 or 30 years. And this, I think, is fundamentally damaging for the, you know, the basic sense of optimism and the sense of progress that is needed to sustain democracy. Why is this happening? I think it's been fairly clear that there are two sources. One has to do, you know, the one that everybody points to is globalization. And that's what links the two parts of this story, so that for every manufacturing job that is now outsourced to Foxconn in China or to a textile factory in Bangladesh, that means fewer similar kinds of jobs in North Carolina or in California or other parts of the developed world. But the more important source of this is really technological change. I have a venture capitalist friend. I live in Palo Alto, California, so I live right in the heart of Silicon Valley. And what this friend of mine says is that every computer genius in Silicon Valley, all of my neighbors, are busy figuring out, they're up 24/7 trying to figure out how to destroy jobs in the rest of the United States. Because it's simply the case that intelligent machines, increasingly intelligent machines, can substitute for many forms of human labor. And in fact, as the IT revolution matures, the number of jobs that can be substituted by machines increases. And so it's not simply repetitive, low-skill kinds of clerical bookkeeping things of that sort, but increasingly jobs that require a certain degree of judgment and intelligence and so forth. And so it turns out if you look at the sources of new employment, it's in the United States very much, I would say a more exaggerated form of what Bernard was describing in Australia. There's many extremely high-paying jobs, you know, particularly in finance. That top 100th are people largely in finance. You get a lot of geneticists and software engineers and people of that sort. And then at the bottom end of the job spectrum, home healthcare workers is one of the largest growing categories, but this is something that pays virtually nothing. And what's being hollowed out are all of the jobs in between. The question then is, what does anyone do about this? And I think this is really the big question that will face all political leaders in democracies if they are interested in the long-term stability of their societies, because a lot of this is being driven by forces that are pretty relentless that you cannot easily control, like the simple march of technology. There are some public policy responses to this. The most popular one among economists is simply better education and training. But the fact of the matter is that that isn't actually going to solve the problem for a lot of categories of people. If you're a male factory worker in your 50s and you've just lost your factory job, it's really not likely that you're going to be retrained as a graphics designer or as a software engineer or as a geneticist or, you know, something of that sort. And I think that we need to think very carefully about the kind of politics that will emerge if this trend continues, because this kind of skewing and skewing of income distribution and lack of opportunity for low-skill workers is, as I said, what's fed populism in regions like Latin America, and I think you can already see this. In my country, in the United States, you have a Tea Party movement that is very anti-elitist, and it talks a very populist kind of rhetoric, and you see this in a lot of populist, anti-European, anti-immigrant parties that have sprung up in virtually every European society. So this is the challenge, I think, that lies ahead for democracy, and it's one that I do not have a good answer for, but that I think we all need to think about. So thank you very much.
Professor Francis Fukuyama, political scientist at Stanford University. On RN and online, you're with Big Ideas. Tonight, can democracy survive a disappearing middle class? The next speaker to consider this question is Professor of Politics at the University of Sydney, John Keane.
I have a half a dozen key points to share with you to get you thinking about this topic of the middle classes and the future of democracy. The first point has to do with exactly what is the middle class. You may know that the term itself has a history. It dates only from the 1740s, and it has changed through time, and it's a controversial category. It's not straightforward, and we should have a discussion about that tonight. During the 19th century, for example, it was used as a synonym for capitalists, those people who had enough capital that they could rival the nobility and screw the proletariat. That was Marx's view. In the century before, the middle class was defined as that bit of the population wedged between the nobility and the peasantry. Into the 20th century, for the first time, a Registrar General's report in the United Kingdom defined the middle class as that place between the working class and the upper class. And meanwhile, you probably know the middle class has been called everything under the sun. Max Weber, the great German sociologist, described the middle class as the standard bearers of the Protestant ethic, the Protestant work ethic. There are those who are less generous. Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, in Saint-Genest, where the middle class is defined as that nervous group that preaches against criminality, that sides with heterosexuality and generally has a fear of deviating from norms. Sometimes the middle classes are praised as standard bearers of reason. That was the view, for example, of Friedrich von Hayek, the Austrian economist. And sometimes the middle class has been seen as dreamers. One of my favorites is E.M. Forster, the writer, who said that one of the definitions of the middle class is that they're those people who abide by the rule, in come the dividends and up go the lofty thoughts. So here we are. Today's statisticians, as you heard from Bernard Salt, are less inclined to épater les bourgeois, to use Flaubert's term. There is a considerable debate about how to define statistically the middle class. Is it those people who live somewhere between the 20th or the 30th and the 80th percentile of consumption distribution? The World Bank defines the middle class as those people with incomes falling between the mean level in Italy and Brazil, $4,000 to $17,000 US dollars. An OECD report, widely circulated, defines the middle class as those people with daily expenditures somewhere between US $10 and $100 per person, and so on. The point is here, the first point is that there's a definite arbitrariness about these definitions. And what's also important to realize is that, of course, none of these make reference to the self-consciousness of people categorized as middle class. In the end, all statistics aside, feeling or being seen as middle class and believing in tomorrow, one of the basic characteristics of a middle class, may well be the most important determinant of how so-called middle class people behave politically. I shall come back to this, but for the moment I want to turn to a second point, and that is to do with the evidence of the decline or expansion of the middle class. This topic certainly needs to be handled with care. Frank Fukuyama has described the American situation, but there is emerging evidence that this is a much more widespread phenomenon in the Atlantic region. So, for example, the Bertelsmann Foundation in Germany quite recently has pinpointed the shrinkage of the middle class within relatively wealthy the German economy, around a shrinkage from around 65% 15 years ago to 58% of the population. There are countries, for example, in the Balkans, Romania, Bulgaria, Croatia, Serbia, where the middle class has actually shrunk to somewhere between 4 and 10% of the population and are often referred to as the invisible class, largely kept alive by foreign investment. The area, I think, geographically, where stern warnings about the disappearance of the middle class and its potentially anti-democratic effects are hail especially from Canada and the United States. You may know that even a museum in memory of the middle class has now actually opened in Schaumburg, Illinois, funded by the Ford Foundation, where if you visit the museum, you can look at these quaint customs from yesteryear, such as free weekends, remember them, day trips, eating at chain family restaurants, and watching television and baseball together. A Canadian report emphasizes this kind of trend. Until recently, it runs, and I'm quoting, "The middle class was in a position that could be reached without grasping, often without a university degree, and enjoyed without too much worry. It meant a stable job, a house with a yard, a two-car garage, and perhaps a nice pension. But it's getting to the point," concludes the report, "where having all of that could make you the envy of your neighborhood." So we see a trend, especially in North America, towards the loss of confidence in the future, the sense that saving for a rainy day belongs to a previous age, that disposable income is being reduced, that retirement plans are often in disarray, that there are disappearing pension schemes, and so on. And only a minority, it turns out, in this region believes any longer that their children will live as well as them. Now, Frank Fukuyama has talked about this this evening, and he's written, I think it's among the very best writing we have about this trend and its political implications. I think Frank Fukuyama might be described as something like a class-conscious defender of the middle classes, of the liberal middle classes. And he calls for a new politics that stands somewhere between David Cameron's concern for the strivers, Ed Miliband's talk of the squeezed middle and Obama's talk of the need for a new economy where there's not a trickle-down effect or belief in a trickle-down effect of wealth, but actually where an economy grows from the middle outwards. Now, we've already covered this territory. I want to add actually a darker note to this, because it seems to me that the situation facing these middle classes in the Atlantic region in our times and for the coming years is rather grimmer. And it's rather grimmer for a couple of reasons. To do with, first of all, the improbability of a return to what Colin Crouch, the British sociologist, once called privatized Keynesianism. I mean, cheap credit that fueled a property boom that gave the sense to many middle-class people that they were becoming wealthier as the days and months and years passed. With the collapse of that, near collapse of that banking and credit sector, the bursting of the bubble, it's unlikely that we will see a return to that period. Or perhaps it will, in which case the observation of Charles Kindleberger, a German-American historian, becomes important. Market economies, according to Kindleberger in a famous study, are prone to produce bubbles. There have been 11 major disruptive bubbles since the Dutch tulip craze in the 1640s, and seven of these have occurred since 1970. And the probability of other bubbles developing in future must surely be high. There is also the point that if you look at the evidence, Frank Fukuyama just raised this, that there is some evidence available that the impact, the job-displacing impact of IT, is beginning to have, as well, reduced productivity gains. That is, the advantage technologically of investing in information and communication systems and the employment potential of that is actually in decline. Third point, this is all bad news for the middle classes, but there is an optimistic note in that. We've heard the phrase already, there is a growth of a global middle class taking place. What is important to emphasize is that this is principally happening, overwhelmingly happening in our region, in the Asia and Pacific region. This is arguably the fastest ever recorded case of embourgeoisement under modern conditions. Its patterns of growth, the growth of this Asia-Pacific middle class, doesn't fit any standard categories. It defies nation-state boundaries. It defies north-south divides, talk of the West or the Third World. So that middle classes in cities like Bangkok and Guangzhou and Jakarta and Seoul are interconnected. The numbers are massive. The OECD report, which I've mentioned already, points out that we're likely to see, on all the evidence that we have, an increase of this middle class, global middle class, from 1.8 billion people to 3.2 billion by 2020, and maybe to 4.9 billion by 2030. And almost 85% of this projected growth is happening in our region. Now, behind these predictions, of course, usually stands the presumed giant of China, where a very large middle class is crystallizing. The size of this Zhongchanjieji, the middle class, is disputed. Some say it's around 12% of the population. Others project that it's growing to something like 30%. One of the great questions in matters of democracy in the middle class is whether this middle class, heavily dependent on the state, will actually choose to conform to that one-party state, to what Min Xinpei calls a decentralized predatory state, or whether the middle classes of China will grow restless. It's a topic that Ben will take up, and I will pass to a fourth point. The key point now is, how reliable are the middle classes? Are they always an ally of democracy? The view that the middle classes have a natural affinity with democracy goes back to Aristotle, the Greek philosopher. If you look carefully at Aristotle, actually, he doesn't talk about democracy. He talks about a political community, a certain type of political system, which he does indeed say needs a middle class. Usually, the view is put that there is somehow an affinity between the middle class and education, caught in the middle. The middle classes like education. They're in favor of reason. They're in favor of public life. They're in favor of respect for truth, for freedom of association. But in fact, the historical record teaches us to be more circumspect. I'm thinking here of a work, it's a famous work in the literature by Barrington Moore, an American historian, who must have written one of the pithiest, shortest sentences in my field: no bourgeois, no democracy. That's often misread to draw the conclusion that a bourgeoisie, a middle class, usually gives rise to some form of, say, parliamentary democracy. If you read Barrington Moore, he points out that actually under modern conditions, in fact, the bourgeoisie went in a number of directions. In one scenario, for example, in China and Russia, the middle classes were more or less annihilated. In another pathway, in Weimar Germany, for example, but also in Japan, the middle classes opted for totalitarian power. It was their outmaneuvering and their conviction that they should depend on the state that led them to reject democracy. It was only, for example, in the case of Britain or France, that the middle classes eventually went for parliamentary democracy. We'd want, I think, to complicate this picture even further, but what I'm suggesting to you is the political promiscuity of the middle classes. There is no law, let's say, of middle class democracy. It depends on the circumstances, it depends on the power conditions, and it depends, of course, on decisions taken by middle class people themselves. This promiscuity certainly applies to our region. If you read the novel by Tash Orr, born in Taiwan, grew up in Malaysia, now living in Britain, five-star billionaire, you will see a picture of struggling middle classes in the 21st century who feel lassitude, who feel fatigue, who suffer political headaches, who generally are irritable, who feel that nothing stands still, that life is just constant elbowing, and it's as if there is some kind of bedeviling of their lives by strange spirits. And it's possible, it's just possible that this kind of condition will lead to a rejection of forms of democracy. I want to introduce to you a big idea. This is a Big Ideas Forum. I suggest that we're living through a very major historical transformation away from parliamentary liberal representative democracy in the form that my grandparents and great-grandparents recognized, towards this, where elections are the centerpiece, parliaments are the centerpiece within territorial states of democracy, towards something like this, what I call monitory democracy, a much more complicated form of democracy, which, in a few words, is a new form of historically of democracy in which free and fair elections remain important, nothing less, but where democracy comes to mean the checking and balancing and public scrutinizing and chastening of power from a whole variety of new institutions that never existed before in the history of democracy. There is, I think, evidence, this is my fifth and soon to be sixth and final point, that the middle classes show some interest in these new forms of democracy, that they have played, in fact, an important role in the building of this new monitory form of democracy. There are some symptoms of this. The fact that the middle classes are no longer party activists. In Australia, the Labour Party has remaining 8,000 activists. It was once a great political machine. Think of the ways in which, since 1945, the middle classes have actually contributed to the growth of new mechanisms that we now associate with democracy. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, peace camps, teach-ins, women's consciousness-raising groups, judicial activism, bioregional assemblies, freedom rides, non-violent coordinating committees of the kind that Martin Luther King was involved with. And more recently, in Japan, after Fukushima, middle-class people have set up radiation detection networks. In Sweden, I read quite recently, middle-class activists under the Occupy banner actually staged a bus safari through the very rich suburbs of Stockholm to teach the middle classes how the really rich live. And in Gezi Park, mentioned by Frank, what is interesting is the growth of all these new mechanisms, monetary mechanisms, balcony protests, the occupation of public squares, sing-ins, pots and pans demonstrations, earth iftar tables, where people break their fast collectively. There is evidence as well that the middle classes are contributing to new forms of governance in city arrangements. The C40 initiative is a case in point. Could it be that just as the middle classes, for example, in Britain and France and in the United States, plumped from the end of the 18th century through the 19th century till roughly World War II for a form of representative parliamentary democracy within territorial states, is it just possible that some parts of the middle class, even parts of that suburban middle class that Bernard Salt spoke about, the thinking people, as Hayek put it, is it just possible that these middle classes are the champions of a new historical form of democracy, a form of democracy in which arbitrary power is not tolerated because it's considered potentially to be the source of great injustice and evil? Thank you very much.
John Keane, Professor of Politics at the University of Sydney. Our final speaker this evening is Benjamin Herskovich. He's a policy analyst and China-based correspondent for this evening's hosts, the Centre for Independent Studies.
I want to start with a brief anecdote. So I've been the CIS's Beijing correspondent of sorts for about 4 months now. In one of my first meetings on the ground, I was told the story of a TV cameraman who works for a Western news organisation. It's a bit sensitive, so let's just call him Mr. X. In 1989, Mr. X was a young and idealistic university student. He was in Tiananmen Square, dodging bullets and risking life and limb, quite literally, for democracy and freedom. Less than 25 years later, though, he's got a spacious apartment in a middle-class suburb. He also has a wife and children and drives a European car. Today, if you asked Mr. X about democracy, he'd probably just shrug his shoulders. Mr. X, by all means, wants less corruption, he wants fewer smog-choked days, and a fairer legal system. But, and this is the crucial point, he is in no mood to be in the firing line again in the name of a regime change. So, in a very real sense, the Chinese Communist Party's rule is an insult to democracy. But Mr. X would say that it's made him comfortable and content. As my co-panelists have suggested, there are real reasons for concern about the health of democracy in the developed world. And I'm sorry to say that I'm basically going to add to the gloom. My argument is essentially Mr. X's story. It's that there are serious questions that need to be asked about democracy's prospects in the developing world, too. So it's commonly thought that as countries become wealthy, they also become democratic. Newly assertive middle-class consumers demand open and accountable democratic government and handcrafted French handbags alike. From Taiwan and South Korea to Turkey and Tunisia, it's thought that democracy rises on the surging prospects of the middle class. And the megatrends seem to confirm this really happy and very encouraging story. As the world grows richer, democracy flourishes. The connection between rising middle-class prosperity and democratization now faces one of its most formidable tests yet. And I assume it'll come as no surprise that when I say that, I'm talking about China. The Middle Kingdom has a massive and growing middle class. It's estimated to be at more than 400 million today, and that's according to HSBC. And the expectation is that it'll balloon to something in the order of 1.3 billion by mid-century. And that basically means that the vast majority of Chinese people at that point in time will be middle class, something like 92%. Despite this, though, The country shows no sign of freeing itself from the grip of authoritarianism. The Chinese Communist Party, or CCP for short, doesn't tolerate any challenge to the one-party state. It controls the judiciary, it censors the internet, and it keeps more than 1,400 political activists behind bars. There are a lot of other points that could be made about that, but that's just a flavour of the extent of the authoritarianism in China. This peculiar combination of material abundance and authoritarianism is a serious challenge to the connection between the middle class and democracy. And it probably leaves us asking whether the worldwide wave of democratization will finally crash on the Great Wall of China. Many of us probably find it quite comforting to think that the Chinese political system will eventually be forced to democratize or die. And conveniently enough, we're in really good company if we hold that view. Min Chin Pei, a world-renowned China scholar, maintains that China's current system is simply morally and intellectually bankrupt. He forcefully argues that it offers no future for the Chinese people. And this is essentially the consensus view. According to most experts, it's not just authoritarian China's economic, social, environmental, and political problems that'll make democratic reforms essential. Although, as we can discuss later, these problems are both serious and numerous. Crucially, the widely held view is that a self-assured Chinese middle class will demand more political freedom from government. It's really easy for middle-class liberals in developed democracies to assume that their peers in the developing world want the same political rights and freedoms that they cherish. And that's probably the position of many of us. There is one really serious problem with this natural inclination, though. It's that, at best, interest in political freedom is lukewarm among China's middle class. Survey data from across China certainly shows that the middle class is eager to protect numerous individual rights and liberties. More than 90% support the protection of rights to work, to education, to free information, to privacy of personal correspondence, and to travel abroad. While more than 80% support the protection of rights to reside anywhere in the country and worship freely. So what this suggests is that middle-class Chinese obviously want personal freedoms. But if we start talking about political freedoms, if we start talking about democracy, the story is remarkably different. As much as 75% of the Chinese middle class, that's 3 in every 4 Chinese middle class people, think that they don't need to participate in government decision making. And only 25% think that multiple parties should be able to contest elections. What's more, fully 86% of middle-class Chinese respect their authoritarian political system, and 83% believe that the CCP represents their interests. If that's not bad enough, it actually gets worse. Only 23% and 24%, respectively, support rights to protest and form non-CCP civil society organizations. With one-party rule firmly entrenched in China, the country certainly suffers from a massive and severe democratic deficit. But it ultimately seems that the middle class just doesn't care. The question of why middle class Chinese have such an easygoing attitude towards authoritarianism is both really interesting and really quite important. Right now, though, the important point is that we need to start asking the question of what will become of democratization in China and the connection between the middle class and democracy. You might think that given the really gloomy picture that I've painted for you so far, that we'll end up with some kind of political stasis. There won't be political change because there's no democratic hunger in China. This kind of pessimism will seem, in all likelihood, really plausible. On the one hand, we have the Chinese middle class's democratic indifference. They just don't seem to care that much about it. And then, on the other hand, we have what is an unyielding commitment to perpetuating a monopoly on political power on the part of the CCP. The kind of bleak assessment that says that there will be political stasis, though, ignores the CCP's strong reformist impulses. Beijing, in actual fact, exhibits genuine resolve to respond to middle-class concerns and public discontent more broadly. The CCP has launched initiatives to tackle chronic pollution, and it plans to clamp down on corruption. It wants to overhaul a deeply unpopular regime of forced land seizures. It also wants to mitigate income inequality, and it wants to enact at least slightly more enlightened policies in west of Western provinces, such as Tibet and Xinjiang. And all the while, it also wants to fuel the continual rise of the middle class by securing ongoing economic expansion. This looks like the start of a really encouraging reform process, but there are some things that we have to acknowledge before we get caught up in the idea that the CCP is a truly enlightened organization which is taking us in the right direction. There are communist hardliners and vested interests that stand in the way of these kinds of positive policy initiatives. There are rusted-on leftists and opportunists, and they don't want change because they're either still committed to communist ideology or they're having a great time on the public teat. At the same time, Beijing's reformism is probably in part calculated to secure the CCP's political survival. The CCP, for all its failings, is without question savvy enough to know that if it wants to rule in perpetuity, it needs to keep the Chinese people, and the middle class in particular, broadly happy with the shape of government. But whatever the challenges and the motivation, Beijing's reformism also represents a very real, as well as a potentially very successful, attempt to make government more responsive and accountable within the framework of one-party rule. So this brings me to the key point that I want to stress in this presentation. The CCP's ambitious reform agenda points to a great irony in contemporary China. The CCP is able to preempt possible middle-class opposition and thereby stave off its political demise precisely by making China's political system more responsive and accountable. This signals the emergence of what I call a model of quasi-democracy in China. The CCP is anxious to minimize potentially explosive dissatisfaction with government, and as a result, seeks to enact policies broadly in keeping with society's wishes. There won't be open and free multi-party elections in China anytime soon. But we can be sure that there'll be less closed-door and rigid decision-making. This effectively means that China under the CCP will probably turn out to be a phantom menace to the connection between democracy and the middle class. And I think that's the real lesson of Mr. X's story, the story that we started with. He might not be interested in full-blown liberal democracy anymore, but he wants a measure of democratic accountability in the form of open and fair legal system and more effective public policy. I want to conclude and predict China's future by going back 2 decades. 1992 saw the publication of one of the most influential post-Cold War works of political science, Frank's The End of History and the Last Man. Its core claim was that liberal democracy constitutes the best possible solution to the human problem. I'm strongly of the view that this is still true, but as what I've said suggests, we arguably need to add one important qualification. Quasi-democratic authoritarian systems, which offer a measure of accountability and responsiveness in the absence of democratic rights and freedoms, offer a fairly good solution to the human problem. Not a great solution, but a fairly good one. And that's why there is so much satisfaction in China, in general, with the authoritarian system that they have. In 1998, US President Bill Clinton was extremely critical of Beijing as a result of its failure to live up to what he called liberal democratic ideals. He made plain that he thought the regime was on the wrong side of history. Now, I have no doubt that that's true of the CCP's brutal, bloody, and ultimately intellectually bankrupt Maoist past. But by pursuing a moderate reformist agenda within the framework of one-party rule, the CCP may yet carve out an enduring place at the end of history for its own brand of quasi-democratic authoritarianism. Thank you.
Benjamin Herskovich, policy analyst with the Center for Independent Studies. You've been listening to highlights of Can Democracy Survive a Disappearing Middle Class? A forum presented by the Center for Independent Studies.